I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress returns to work this week with an eye on the Gulf. This morning, Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen said that that cap on BP's Gushing well is working to siphon oil, but much is still spewing out. So there's that. 10 states will hold primaries tomorrow, and this week Congress will debate tougher regulation on banks through financial reform. Rick Klein is senior Washington News editor for ABC World News and host of the network's webcast Top Line. And Rick, you say everything is taking back seat to the Gulf this week. So is this success with the cap enough to take some of the political heat off the Obama administration?
You know, I personally, I think this is going to last a while, and I think people's perceptions are pretty much kicked in. We have a new ABC News Washington Post poll out just this afternoon that finds 69% of people rate the federal response negatively. Only 62% had a similar negative rating to the federal response to Katrina a couple weeks after that hurricane. Now, obviously, this has been going on longer. People have seen these images for a much greater period of time, but I feel like the public perceptions around the federal response are pretty fairly caked in, and we're likely to see, even if we begin to contain the oil that's leaking, we're going to see the fallout of this for months, maybe years to come along the coastline.
Well, and there have been hearings, but you expect more or different action now that Congress is back. We saw such emotional testimony in some of those hearings. Here is Louisiana Congressman Charlie Melanson breaking down during a House Energy Subcommittee hearing on May 27th.
Our culture is threatened, our coastal economy is threatened, and everything that I know and love is at risk. Even though this marsh lies, along coastal Louisiana, these are America's wetlands.
Rick Klein, pretty powerful stuff from a Louisiana congressman, but do you see Congress coming back, rolling up sleeves to try to do something or make political hay?
Well, I think the one thing we're likely to see out of this is a new push around a comprehensive energy bill. There's going to be a lot of talk about what BP should do, about raising caps on limits. But if there's a chance to do a comprehensive energy and environmental bill, the cap and trade plan that Kerry and Lieberman put forward, it may be in the wake of this. They're not going to have a better opportunity to focus public debate. But by the same token, it's hard to imagine any scenario that's going to have increased oil drilling as part of it. And it's hard to imagine getting Republican votes without that.
Well, let's tick through tomorrow's primaries. In Nevada, Republicans choosing a candidate to run against Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid. On the Republican side, you have Sue Loudon. She's been called the establishment candidate, former chair of the Nevada Republican Party. You have Sharon Engel, businessman Danny Tarkanian. It's gotten ugly having to do with Sue Loudon, again, the former chair of the Nevada GOP, talking about people getting health care by trading chickens. Just give us a little sense of this race tomorrow.
Well, you've got all three candidates are confirmed Tea Partiers. They're all trying to tap into Tea Party energy and momentum. And it's really had the effect of moving the whole primary field to the right. And you have now Sharon Engel, the late surging candidate who's favored by some of the national Tea Party organizations. She wants to abolish the Department of Education, Department of Energy. She wants to get rid of the federal income tax, phase out Social Security reform. Those are the kind of positions that Democrats would love to see in a Senate candidate in a state like Nevada. It may actually be what saves Harry Reid ultimately. If they end up nominating someone who is seen as out of the mainstream in Nevada, that may be exactly what the Senate Majority Leader likes to hear.
Well, and staying in Nevada, you have a gubernatorial primary tomorrow with the one-term incumbent, the Governor Jim Gibbons, who was a Tea Party-backed candidate a year ago. He's now fighting off charges of sexually threatening a waitress. His defense has been that he's not had sex since 1995. Again, you know, kind of a wild ride there.
Yeah, and I'd want to say only in Nevada, except you've got in South Carolina something just as wacky with a female candidate for governor who's fended off charges from two different people that she had extramarital affairs. So it's a bizarre series of primaries, you're exactly right, and a lot of unpredictable outcomes as a result.
Well, let's skip to South Carolina. You're speaking of Nikki Haley, who's running for the Republican nomination for governor there in South Carolina, running with Sarah Palin's blessing, but as you said, also charged not by just anybody, but by two Republican operatives with having affairs with them. How's this playing out there?
Yeah, and this is Mark Sanford's seat that they're running for, someone familiar with a sex scandal. She has said that she would resign her office if any of these charges were documented and true. Of course, that would only happen after an election. So the question goes to primary voters whether you're comfortable with this. She does appear, though, likely to pull it out, running against Lieutenant Governor Andre Bauer, who's been trying to win this seat in his own right. It is, though, it, it's going to be a test of Sarah Palin's pull, in part because Sarah Palin has stuck by Nikki Haley, even in the wake of these two public airing of charges of extramarital affairs.
Well, and you've also got a lot of women running for Republican posts in primaries in California tomorrow. There's a gubernatorial race between former eBay CEO Meg Whitman and Tea Party favorite Steve Poizner. He calls Whitman a rhino, Republican in name only. In the Senate race tomorrow to pick a Republican candidate to face Democrat Barbara Boxer in the fall, you've got former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina, who's leading in the polls over Representative Tom Campbell, Assemblyman Chuck DeVore. Just your thoughts on the number of women running.
Well, I think it's going to be an interesting storyline that's told, not just there, but in New Mexico, for instance. Both candidates for governor are going to be women in all likelihood. But for Republicans in particular, to have Carly Fiorina and Meg Whitman as their standard bearers in the nation's biggest state, traditionally a blue state, gives a chance to tell a different kind of story. It's not, though, necessarily a story that the individual candidates want to tell. Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina have their own separate business records that they would rather not have associated with the other one. So I don't think we're going to see them run as a team, but it is intriguing and certainly a different type of candidate than we've seen in the past.
Rick Klein, Senior Washington News Editor for ABC World News, host of the network's webcast Top Line. Rick, thank you for helping us set the table for the week ahead.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Sarah Palin, for one, says that oil companies are forced into dangerous deep-sea drilling because land drilling has been limited. She's part of a push to open up drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. In Utah and Montana, there are also drilling restrictions based on environmental concerns. But in North Dakota, drilling is booming. Oil companies say that in the last decade, they've found what may be the largest discovery of underground oil in recent history. 52 drilling rigs were operating in North Dakota by December 2008. By October 2009, nearly 200 new wells had been drilled. North Dakota is producing just a fraction of the oil used by the country. It's way behind Alaska and Louisiana. But still, what's it like to be in the middle of an oil boom? Ward Kozer is the mayor of Williston, North Dakota, population 12,000. In 1978, he moved to North Dakota to participate in the state's last oil boom, which fizzled out and left many with bad debt. So, Mayor, tell us, what went wrong in the 70s?
Well, I moved here, like you said, in 1978, actually to start a business that catered to the oil industry. And things were great at first. We were going through a boom, and there was just a lot of activity. The city experienced tremendous growth, and everyone was doing well. And then the price of crude took a dive. And when that happened, the companies that were drilling for oil decided to go elsewhere, in some cases other parts of the United States, in other cases overseas. And so it slowed down. And, of course, that having that happen to us as a community has made us a little more, I guess, conservative, you might say,
yeah,
a little more sensitive to certain issues this go around.
Well, and this time around, are these exploratory wells or are there actually rigs pumping oil? What's different?
Well, what they've found here is what's called the Bakken Formation. It's a formation that's located about 2 miles underneath the ground. And then they have some new technology where what they call fracking. They actually drill down about 2 miles, and then the pipe turns, and they drill for another 2 miles. And that horizontal 2 miles, then they actually frack, where they pump down high pressure water and sand that breaks open the rock, and then the oil is able to come to the surface. Very successful. They probably have about a 99% success rate on the wells they drill here now.
Well, and we understand as many as 10 to 20,000 wells could be drilled in this patch that you're talking about within two decades. So what does that mean for workers coming in? What are you seeing?
Well, we're having a difficult time. First of all, finding housing for the workers is probably the biggest challenge. With the economy the way it is around the country, a lot of people are recognizing that this is a good place to move to and, you know, start a new career, and so they're coming in large numbers. But what's happening is we're having a difficult time finding a place for them to live.
Well, and so, for instance, you have things called man camps. What's that?
Well, a man camp is temporary housing. It would remind you of a dormitory, and companies such as Halliburton, as an example, would put in a man camp. They have a lot of employees in our community. I don't know, probably 500 or 600 employees. Since they don't have houses for all of them, they put up these man camps, and then they allow their workers to stay there. But I would liken them to a dormitory. Gives them a good quarters to live in a bed, and the various things that they need to survive.
Well, in other cases, we know some of the temporary housing that was used for security guards up in the Vancouver Olympics has been moved down into some areas, just sort of throwing up these temporary living places. What does that feel like? How does that impact a small town?
Well, you know, we certainly would prefer to have people move here with their family into a house. And that's what we're focusing on, is building housing for that and apartments to rent and things. But you just simply cannot increase the number of housing units quick enough. If you look at the last probably 5 months, there's probably been close to 2,000 jobs added in our community. And so we recognize we have to use some of this temporary housing. But there are good people coming here. I guess we're real pleased. They have a good work ethic in general. And I think they're going to fall in love with North Dakota.
Well, as you did when you came. But
right.
You know, but we're reading things like in Ross, North Dakota, the town's population went from 49 to 200. Stanley went from 1,200 to double that. So what kind of impact does it have on, I mean, we're thinking sewer systems, well, schools?
Yeah, you know, we're all impacted. The schools, for an example, I think throughout the region are looking at increased numbers in the fall. Many of the oil workers moving here are young people, and they have young families. Everybody is challenged. Your hospital, for an example, is challenged because as they hire workers, they don't have a place for them to live. The school teachers, who the school may be looking to hire, you know, are willing to come here, but they have to find a place to live. So the challenges are great. And for an example, today I had a guy stop and see me who's looking to develop some property, and there's a main thoroughfare that goes through it, and they're debating how much of this cost should they have to pay. And I can recognize, you know, their concern in that particular area. And we had a special commission meeting last night where we approved a contract to sell water to an adjacent county. The oil industry uses a lot of water, and so we've agreed, because since we have some excess capacity, to sell them water. Because of the air traffic, we need to build a new hangar out at the airport so that we can provide maintenance for the airlines that come in here, and that's something new that came with the increased traffic. And there's just a number of things.
Well, I can imagine if somebody suddenly got 35 rigs that are pumping oil, they're going to have huge tanker trucks suddenly drive.
Unreal. When you drill a well out here, it takes about 1,250 semi-loads in and out of that rig to drill that well. Now, that's done in about a month's time, so you can imagine how much truck traffic that is. So you have that whole issue. And what the trucks do to the roads, a lot of the roads in the country are just gravel or dirt roads, and they're not designed for these heavy tankers, and so they literally destroy the roads. And the county then has to determine how are they going to pay to fix the roads and satisfy the farmers who are living out there wanting to take their crops to market. So it's a challenge, but I always tell our people, with challenges come opportunities, and so that's how we're trying to focus on it.
Well, and as you said, developers may be bringing housing and oil companies jobs, but they're also asking you and the state to pay for services like roads and sewers. That's Ward Kozer, mayor of Williston, North Dakota, one of many North Dakota towns experiencing an oil boom, workers from out of state, but also so many workers in state switching to oil jobs that restaurants have had to shorten hours. One fast food facility is offering a signing bonus for workers. We're going to hear more. Also later today, Turkey's emerging role as a leader in the Middle East. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're looking at North Dakota's oil boom. So many workers flocking to the state, they're living in man camps and partitioned containers called skid shacks. And in the town of Williston, schools are being inundated. We're speaking with Ward Kozer. He's mayor of Williston. And Mayor Kozer, so there are problems, but also the boom has pushed state revenues through the roof. There's an oil extraction tax. There's production taxes on the oil companies. Revenue from that's going to exceed $500 million this year. And there's a big debate about what should be done with that money. In Alaska, they give a percentage of oil revenues back to residents every year, but North Dakota has a law against that, but there's a debate about changing that law. Also, a push to keep that money in a trust. So, first of all, is any of that money trickling back to you?
Well, you know, a certain amount of it comes back to the local communities to help with the impact on the infrastructure that they have. But a lot of it stays with the state, and it's interesting, the voters of the state will be voting in November on what we call a legacy fund, and that would be a fund a little bit like what Alaska does, where some of this would be put into a special fund that could be used in emergencies and to do special projects in the state. So the money is great, and I think we're one of the very few states in the nation that has a budget surplus. At our last biennium, we had a $1 billion surplus. So there's a real blessing, but with that blessing comes some challenges, and that's what we're trying to deal with.
Well, and one of them is a way of life. I mean, I love, right. I've been to North Dakota, love it. And one of the reasons people love North Dakota is the peace and the quiet and the sense that there aren't a lot of people around. And are there people saying, well, wait a second?
Yeah, there are those who are kind of complaining about the traffic now. And when you go to work in the morning, you may sit at the stoplight for a lot longer than you're used to. And, you know, when you're eating in a restaurant, it's full and you have to wait to get a place to be seated. And those issues that come with more people, the thing that I think about is these people come, they really give us a diversity. As we talked about earlier, I moved here in 1978 and fell in love with the place and can't imagine myself ever leaving. And I really believe that a lot of the people who come here will fall in love with North Dakota and want to stay here. But in the meantime, it's a little different than it was before. And there are some who, kind of liked it in the way it was in the good old days.
Well, when you could stare at this horizon that would go forever, and now we understand you'll see rigs, and gas flares, like Texas. But there's also, we understand, questions about, is the system fair and equitable? We have farmers giving up land. You know, the oil company comes in and says there's oil here. It works out well for the farmers in that they get a one-time lease payment for the land needed to drill a well, usually around 5 acres. But some of the farmers are saying, well, wait a second, that one-time payment, considering what the oil company gets, maybe it should be readjusted. Are there questions like that?
Sure, there certainly are. If you own the minerals under your land, then you're going to receive an ongoing payment. You'll receive a royalty as they produce the oil.
Right.
But if you happen to be a landowner where somebody else owns the minerals, you get, like you said, you get the one-time payment for them to move the rig on. And for people like that, obviously, it can be a real nuisance. I mean, you have the noise, you have the extra traffic, the issues that come with drilling a well. And I think that will be continued to be looked at, is to say, is there a way that we can make that a little more equitable? So if somebody is the landowner, the surface owner, and has a well drilled there, is there some way that he can receive some ongoing benefits, not just the one-time fee for drilling the well?
Well, and boy, we understand one of the reasons these workers are coming from all across the country, mostly men, is that they can make up to, well, we're reading about one guy living practically out of his car. He can make $150,000 in a good year.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. But he's wiring a lot of it home to his family out of state.
Sure. The oil industry tends to pay well, and they have good benefits. They're good employers now. Back in the 80s when we had a boom and bust, it was kind of a wild and rowdy place to be. But this go-round, the companies do a lot of drug testing. They want to make sure that their employees behave themselves and are good employees. And they're looking for a professional worker now. There's a lot more technology in the oil industry than there was, 30 years ago. It's a great career for people, so that's why I think we're seeing so many move here. Once again, they just are having a difficult time finding a place to live.
Well, and I'm imagining that given that's another reason that you want to hurry up and get housing, because then that revenue stays there.
Right. If they're living in a tent in the park someplace or in their vehicle in the Walmart parking lot, we don't get any revenue from them. But, if they rent a place or if they own a home, then they become part of our community. Their kids are in our school system, and that just works better for everybody.
So, Ward Kozer, you went through a boom and bust. You're now in the middle of a boom. You said that people like you are hesitant, having seen a bust, that there might be another one. There's that question as well, as you all watch what's happening in the Gulf. Now, a completely different situation, not just offshore, but the deepest offshore ever. You're there on land. But is there nervousness there, too?
Well, the nervousness here comes is the fact that, oil, the price of oil has always been cyclical. So those of us who lived through the last boom bust realize that the day may come when the price of crude isn't what it is today, and that would cause activity to slow down. So we're really trying to make sure that we, we move forward. You have to take some risks, but that we limit the risks, that we position the community, for healthy growth. And I think we're having pretty good luck with that. I think we're succeeding in that area. But one of the things that happens when people are concerned about the future is they're hesitant to invest. And so it's been more of a challenge to get, developers to come here and invest millions of dollars in putting in infrastructure and building buildings and renting apartments and whatever. if they're not sure of the future. So we experience that hesitancy on a daily basis.
Yeah. Well, all in all, Mayor Koser, a benefit, a mana from heaven, or a Faustian pact?
It's definitely a benefit. I mean, we are blessed. We're really blessed. We have a very, very strong economy in our town. We have some wonderful people moving here looking to make this their home. There's some challenges that are coming with it, but I think if we do our homework and use some common sense, I think we're going to come through this in a good position and look forward to a bright future.
That's Ward Koser, mayor of Williston, North Dakota, which is smack in the middle of an oil boom in North Dakota. Mayor Koser, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Israel says it prevented a terrorist attack by Palestinian militants today when its navy opened fire on a boat off the coast of Gaza, killing 4 men in diving gear. Of course, this is 1 week after Israel's raid on that ship and a flotilla carrying aid to Gaza that left 9 Turks dead. Coming up, Turkey's emerging role, but first, today's news. The BBC's John Donison joins us from Ramallah in the West Bank. Now, John, Hamas controls Gaza. Fatah governs the West Bank where you are, but we hear that the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, a militant group linked to Fatah, says that these were their men off the Gaza coast.
That's right. A spokesman for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade has said they were carrying out a training exercise about 100 metres off the shore. Now, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade are rivals of Hamas. In fact, Hamas tried to violently force them out of Gaza and did so, really, in 2007. So one of the things it's important to understand is that there are numerous militant groups in Gaza. Hamas is in control of the Gaza Strip, but it does not, frankly, have control over all the militant groups, although from Israel's perspective, they say, well, look, you're in charge, so you should be able to control the territory.
Well, and so in your answer, I'm hearing there's no reason to believe that Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade and Hamas were working together.
No, in fact, often when you hear people from Hamas talking about people from Fatah, they talk about them in the same kind of terms that they would talk about the Israelis.
And what is your sense of whether or not these really were Palestinians on a training mission and what that all means?
There is a real debate in Gaza, and particularly amongst the various militant factions, about the sort of resistance they should be putting up. And I actually put this to a Hamas official this week. I said, look, of all weeks, surely this is the week where you should be trying to rein in militant activity, given that, in general, the sympathies of the world are with the Palestinian people, and surely you're just giving an excuse to Israel to carry out its actions. Israel would say, well, look, you're doing this, you're carrying out militant action, so this is why we need the blockade. And the Hamas official dodged the question, really, and he said, well, all our militants group reserve the right to put up resistance when they want, and frankly, they don't have control over every militant group in Gaza.
Well, and this underscores the difficulty in addressing the Palestinian situation, that they don't speak in one voice. But Israel, which has withdrawn forces from Gaza but still controls and occupies the sea, they say this attack is proof that they still need to do that, control the sea. Have Palestinians attacked Israel from the sea?
In February, we had an incident where explosive devices were floated off the coast in Gaza, and they ended up washing up on beaches, Israeli beaches, and they were detonated safely by Israeli security officers. One of the things I was struck by when I arrived in Gaza was you often hear machine gun fire in the mornings. My ears would prick up and I'd look around and no one was batting an eyelid. But this is the Israeli Navy often firing upon Palestinian fishing boats it thinks have strayed beyond their limits.
Well, John, we want to ask you, as we said, this comes almost a week after the Israeli raid on the ships trying to break the Gaza blockade and bring aid to Palestinians. Israel also intercepted another ship over the weekend. This was the Irish-owned Rachel Corrie. And it was a much quieter situation. We understand the government of Ireland agreed with Israel that it should go through an Israeli port before bringing aid to Palestinians. What's the sense, from your vantage point, what sense do you get in Israel of the debate over what Israel is doing in intercepting those ships?
There is a minority, I think, in Israel who believe the blockade is counterproductive. In other words, it makes life very difficult for people in Gaza, which tends to encourage people to move towards extremism. But generally, I think in Israel, people think the blockade is necessary for their security because there remains sporadic rocket fire out of Gaza. It's often very ineffectual, but nevertheless, people do see this as a threat.
Well, we should note that both Israel and Egypt have maintained this blockade of Gaza since Hamas took control 3 years ago. But today, Egypt is saying it's going to open the border because it says that the closure has just failed to achieve its goals. The BBC's John Donison, he's been speaking to us from Ramallah in the West Bank. John, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
And this quick note, veteran columnist Helen Thomas is retiring after a comment about Israel. Recently, she said Israel should get the hell out of Palestine. Her comments were posted on YouTube. She later apologized. But today, Hearst announced the 89-year-old is retiring. Well, we'll take a quick break. Be back with a look at Turkey here and now. Israel is likely to be a no-show at a regional security conference in Istanbul this week. Turkey plans to use the meeting to further condemn Israel for last week's raid on that flotilla headed toward Gaza. Turkey has traditionally been Israel's most important ally in the Muslim world. Now it's threatening to cut military and trade ties. What are the ramifications of Turkey's tough stance with Israel? For Turks, for the region, and for the U.S.? And will Turkey continue its bid for EU membership, which has already led the country to institute a series of democratic reforms? Gulvide Ozgur is the U.S. correspondent for the Turkish 24-hour news channel Haber Türk. And Gulvide, start with the Turks. How are they feeling?
Well, first of all, they're very upset over what happened last week with 9 Turks being killed on Mavi Marmara. But other than that, they actually enjoy the regional role that Turkey has started to play in the last probably 5 years. I mean, the foreign ministry of Turkey has established this new foreign policy focusing on zero problems with the neighbors, trade relations and bilateral relations with Russia, Syria, and Iraq.
You say there's a sense of national pride, and when you say zero problems with the neighbors, he's trying to reduce the problems to zero. Just want to mention in passing, we're reading that not all Turks are on board with the recent attitude towards Israel. We read a columnist, for instance, asking, what do Palestinians have to do with me?
We have different opinions coming out of Turkey, but what I can give you is the majority of people in Turkey are in support of Palestinian cause. But we also have some analysts and columnists that actually heavily criticize the government with its handling this problem. I mean, Turkey has enjoyed good relations and peaceful relations with Israel, and they have enjoyed military relations, and they have conducted numerous military exercises. So Israel also should realize the ramifications of losing a friend, the only friend in the region.
In recent years, President Obama has seen Turkey as a vital bridge to the Middle East. But as we're seeing, Turkey is now the world's 16th largest economy, you know, maybe forging a different path, issuing statements of support for Hamas, for instance. How is this affecting U.S.-Turkish relations?
Turkey not officially hasn't had any relationship with Hamas. It's been done all on civil society level. So, and also Turkey thinks that if nobody speaks to those people, then who is going to speak? And also Turkey has enjoyed good relationship with the United States throughout the Cold War and after the Cold War. But today, it has changed because Turkey economically can stand on its own without any financial aid, neither from IMF nor from the United States. It feels self-confident, and it feels like it can actually solve some of the problems or help solve some of the problems in the region that are in Turkey's interest, and it can actually easily be turned into the United States' interest.
You mentioned support for the Palestinians and Hamas. We know that Turkey is now under the rule of Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and he's compared Hamas to his political party, pointing out that his political party was once illegal. His party is the Islamist AKP party. Now, what about concerns that because he is Islamist, that the country is sliding into a more radical Islam? The parliament recently passed an amendment allowing women, for instance, to wear headscarves on college campuses. Is there concern of, you know, sort of a creeping Islamization?
I can agree with the statement that, yes, you can see more pious and religious people in society when you walk on the street. And it's something that actually nowadays or recently Turkish people are enjoying. It came with the EU reforms. Before, those people were usually used to stay behind closed doors, and because of the democratization reforms that Turkey has undergone because of the EU reform requirements, now those people feel more comfortable to walk on the streets, to be more in the public sphere. As for radicalization, I don't know how true that would be, because Turks, even the most pious ones, are not in support of Sharia law. There was a research conducted, a poll conducted, and only 3% said that they're in favor of Sharia law. So that shows that people actually could be religious and pious, but at the same time could be also pro-European and Western, and could also embrace European principles of freedom and democratization.
We should point out that the foreign minister of Turkey is not Islamist. But what about concerns about the Islamist charity group IHH? They were behind the flotilla. They claim to be strictly humanitarian, but they are a member of the Union of Good. The U.S. government claims that was set up to transfer funds to Hamas. And in 1997, a raid of an IHH building in Istanbul found weapons, explosives, and such. And there are claims that IHH has ties to al-Qaeda, and specifically the failed millennial bombing here in the U.S.
None of these have been proven yet. Last week, State Department spokesman Philip Crowley actually said that they haven't been, I mean, they were some ties to Hamas, but they weren't able to prove that there are actually ties with al-Qaeda.
How are the other Muslim countries in the region reacting to Turkey?
Never before in Turkish history where so many Arab countries will watch Turkey so closely and will have so many correspondents based in Turkey reporting back to their countries. And it has actually happened after Turkey's EU talks started in 2003. And Arab world is pretty much watching Turkey very closely in its admission to the EU. So accepting Turkey as a member will send a very positive message out there to the Muslim world. And it will show that West is not against Islam, that it's embracing a member that is predominantly Muslim. And when you have German Chancellor Angela Merkel and when you have French President Sarkozy saying that no matter what, even Turkey fulfills the criteria, it still won't be allowed in the European club, then it's very damaging and it sends very negative messages out there.
Well, what do you think? Do you think that Turkey even cares anymore about joining the EU? We just saw the tremendous financial havoc caused by the debt in Greece. Does Turkey want to be a part of the EU?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question because, yes, it's true that EU has lost its attraction to many Turks, but regardless of whether Turkey will enter the EU or not, there is a gap in the Middle East that hasn't been filled for years, and U.S. has tried to play an active role in initiating peace between Palestinians and Israelis, but it has failed so many times that right now there is no confidence in Turkish people that U.S. actually can do something about it. So Turkey sees a role for herself to play out there.
Gulvide Ozgur, U.S. correspondent for the Turkish 24-hour news channel Habertürk, speaking to us from the Argo studios in New York, about Turkey and its growing influence in its region. Gulvide, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Choreographer and MacArthur Genius Grant recipient Elizabeth Streb has been called the Evel Knievel of dance. She dove through glass in a piece called Breakthrough. In falling, her dancers do full-on belly flops from a height of about 30 feet onto an amplified mat. In other pieces, dancers maneuver around huge swinging steel I-beams and concrete blocks that miss them by just inches. They fling themselves against plexiglass or squirm through what looks like a human ant farm or jog and flip on a contraption that looks like a huge human hamster wheel. No wonder Streb calls them action engineers, not dancers, and she doesn't call it dance. Elizabeth Streb has a new book out. It's called Streb, How to Become an Extreme Action Hero. She joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin.
I have to say, I feel like I have been joined by an action hero. First of all, having seen you, black, it's almost like a mohawk haircut straight up, your black outfit, your black eyeglasses. Do you whip that off? Are you going to dive through our window here?
I'm considering it. Well, I thought that the mohawk hairstyle, when I run into kids that are in high school and they look at me and they're not sure what age I am, and I'm 60, this is a hairstyle you'd have if you were falling. All your hair goes up. So I thought it was a practical, physical thing.
You're constantly falling. How do you feel about gravity? Are you trying to prove that it doesn't exist, or it doesn't exist in the way that we think it does?
Actually, I am obsessed with gravity, and my complaint with the dance world and other forms of action, such as the circus and gymnastics, is that they do an enormous amount, go to a lot of technical trouble to camouflage gravity. And for me, the holy elixir, the holy grail of action, is encased in what gravity is capable of doing. It's so compelling, in my opinion, and so non-predictive that you really skip your brain. You know, it goes right from your perceptors, the eyeballs, right through your gut and out the flesh of your body. And for me, action in that sense is an experience. And for me, dance is more visual and more oral.
Well, which is why you have these mats where we can really hear when the dancers dive from 30 feet into them and belly flop and such. But you mentioned how the experience goes right through you. And we sit there worrying that the props will go right through the dancer. You have these steel beams. They're dancing around. You have these huge concrete blocks. Just want to ask you about the extreme part, the danger part. Because in your book, we learn that you once lit yourself on fire for your girlfriend's birthday. You wanted to smoosh a fire on the floor by landing belly flop on it. You ended up with a burn mark. And then earlier, as a young child, you set your uncle's barn on fire by accident. You lit the hay. And you said you didn't want to put it out because it was so magnificent to watch. This idea, yes, that you sort of like to watch the danger part.
Well, I think that if one reassesses what the definition of physical danger is, and certainly let's leave fire on the side because that was just pure foolishness on my part. Actually, I'm thinking that if we are not in an unhabitual place in space physically, then we're in a cliche-ridden place in space.
Wait. I got to hear that again. If we're not in an unhabitual place, what do you mean?
A place where immediately you get to that your body doesn't recognize. Could be that you've built a hill at a 45-degree angle and you're running up it. Or it could be that you're on a big hamster wheel and you're running and you stop running, and in a half a second, you're up 15 feet.
Right, you're thrown off it. Right.
You're thrown off it. So what I mean is that you create a physical condition with the machinery, and then you throw the dancers in there, and they have to have physical responses, which change the rhythm of the events that are happening from a musical rhythm to an abrupt and almost an ecstatic rhythm.
Do you worry about them? I mean, there's something mesmerizing about watching someone try to stay on top of a hamster wheel and running, or you know, doing some of these other extreme moves that we see, but do you worry about them doing it for you? Because it seems as if they'd do anything for you. And as you well know, there was a dancer who did get hurt. She broke her back in a fall, yeah, and it was, yeah, quite controversial.
Very, yes.
So do you worry about what you ask them to do?
Very, very much. I mean, I am unbelievably nervous in the studio. And because I'm not a practitioner anymore, I retired when I was 48, 12 years ago. My job is to keep them safe. And when that doesn't happen, I'm devastated. I ask the dancers to respond to a bad set of events within a split second. And you really never know if someone can do that or someone's going to freeze in the headlights. And I think that I can honestly say that there's a way out every time something goes amok with a situation that the dancers are physicalizing. If I didn't believe that, then I would have to back up all the way from the danger line and more or less start over with my project.
But who's going to be the first dancer to step up and say, I'll find out, Elizabeth, if that's going to work? For instance, you have a drawing of an elephant.
Oh, I know. I haven't done that piece yet.
Well, we want to be there when you do. It's a drawing of an... I guess you were wondering what would happen if an elephant stood and spread its weight around four different people that the elephant would stand on.
Exactly.
So who gets to be the first four who try that for you?
Well, in fact, that idea came about, if I may, from Ken Felt, who owns Ringling Brothers Circus. And I thought this piece that you described would be about weight. I even talked to an elephant trainer, and the elephant trainer said the hardest thing would be teaching the elephant actually to step on a person. The crazy thing is he didn't say it was impossible, so that's why it's in the book.
Well, I'm not sure we want to find out on that case, but do you feel like a superhero? You're not doing this now, but when you were doing it, do you?
Oh, you really do. Like when I was on fire that time, the next day I walked down the street and I looked at complete strangers and I go, I was on fire yesterday. You just feel that it must mean that, and I think people watching it get this too, that you're transformed somehow, that even the small things in life that used to be difficult, there's nothing you can't do. I think movement lends that to us.
Well, and we should say you run a huge factory space in Brooklyn. It's called SLAM, the Streb Lab for Action Mechanics, kind of a lab for movement exploration. It's open to the public. You perform there. Anna Deavere Smith writes the foreword to your book, and she writes, if you go to a Streb matinee, you'll find a throng of kids completely enthralled having fun. So we were thinking about the kids part. Do you tell kids, as people are diving through glass or cement blocks are going within an inch of someone's face, don't try this at home? Or what are you telling them?
We do every time we remember to say, don't forget, we're professionals, do not try this at home. But the kids, for me, are a fervent, almost a petri dish for some of the most unbelievable information regarding real action. Because my search, really, and it gets laid out in the book, is to discover what is a real move. And is there such a thing? Can you do it in a human form without dying?
What do you mean?
Well, to accomplish it. I know that a real move is, for instance, something you get hurt trying to stop. I know a real move is something that once it starts, you can't change your mind about it. It has to complete itself. A real move is something that will be so startling to the onlooker that whether you're having the most intellectual conversation with the smartest person on earth, it'll take your attention away from that. But kids embody real movement because they move with a purity that adults have long lost.
Just give us one, something you saw a kid do and you went, oh my gosh.
Yeah, a 360 clump drop.
Wait, a 360?
Clump drop.
Clump drop.
You're running, and this little kid was running, and then you hurl your body into the air, do a 360, and then land in a clump.
Oh my gosh.
This little fellow did it so fast, with so much power and so much glee, that it was shocking.
Meanwhile, I've made note to myself, try a 360 clump drop.
On a mat.
On a mat, right. That's Elizabeth Streb. Her new book is called Streb, How to Become an Extreme Action Hero. For more about the book and her factory space in Brooklyn, SLAM, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Elizabeth, thanks so much. What a pleasure to meet you.
It was a complete pleasure. Thank you, Robin.